morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass.
And school is back in a few days before winter break. The book club selection for December is the 1849 essay Civil Disobedience, the extremely influential essay by transcendentalist Henry David Thoreau. He writes about the night that he spent in jail for not paying his taxes, and we'll get the story on that. His ideas famously inspired Gandhi, who carried a copy of Civil Disobedience with him, Martin Luther King Jr., Tolstoy, and many others. Joining us once again is Russ Castronovo, who's professor of English and American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's been our regular teacher for all of our book club discussions. Hello again, Russ. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
And also joining us for the discussion is political philosopher Alex Sakaris. He's associate professor at the University of Vermont. Alex, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Before we talk about the times, what was going on in the country at this time, which is a fascinating story, I have heard that this may be the most influential essay that has ever been written. Would both of you agree with that, Russ, starting with you?
Most influential. I would put it up there in the top five.
And you, Alex?
I think, well, that's a difficult question to answer, of course, but it has been tremendously influential.
And continues to be influential. It's amazing. It was written in 1849, but it's been talked about and thought about by generations of young people and also people who are leading significant movements in various parts of the world.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Kathleen. You know, it had a profound influence on Gandhi, on Martin Luther King, and I think you can even see its reverberations through something like Occupy Wall Street.
If mm-hmm.
You know, I just wanted to read a little bit of what King said about Thoreau. He said that the teachings of Thoreau, whether expressed in a sit-in at lunch counters, a freedom ride in Mississippi, a peaceful protest in Albany, Georgia, a bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama, these are outgrowths of Thoreau's insistence that evil must be resisted and that no moral man can patiently adjust to injustice.
Mm. He requires our deepest thoughts and contemplation about important issues. We do want to remind you right off the bat here, many of you have read Civil Disobedience for our book club. And if you have thoughts or questions about Thoreau or Civil Disobedience, our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. You can also post to our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show, or you can send a tweet. We have all kinds of ways of communication, and that's at K. Dunn Show. Let's put Henry David Thoreau in his time, Russ, and let's talk about the important issues that were being discussed and circulating in this country in the 1840s, both in the state where he was, Massachusetts, and also in the country.
Right. There are two connected issues for Thoreau. One is the Mexican-American War, which starts in 1846, and the other is slavery. And he sees these two as linked. So first of all, he is horrified by the fact that the United States is conducting an imperial war, that it's the invading army in another land. And he sees that this is going to have tremendous consequences for the moral character and also political character of the United States, because he knows, just as about everyone in the United States at that time knew, that this is a land to seize territory. And what's going to happen with that territory, since it's all south of the Mason-Dixon line, is that it will enter the United States as slave territory. So he sees this not only as an imperialist war, but as a war to extend the scope of slavery in the United States. And he just cannot abide by these two, you know, as Martin Luther King would later say, these two grave injustices.
Mm-hmm. And was there widespread agreement with his opposition to this war, or was it something that not very many people were concerned about?
You know, as in his circles of northern liberal circles among transcendentalists in places like Concord and places like Boston, those connections were readily made. And it's, you know, one of the first sort of wars where the United States kind of trumps and builds up a reason to invade another country. And so Thoreau, I think, along with people like Emerson, along with important journals in the Northeast, like the United States Democratic Review, see that this war is being conducted on sort of false premises. And not only are the premises false, but the outcome, the results, the effects are going to be momentous. And that's what he and other northern public figures were quite concerned about.
Mm-hmm. And let's spend a little more time, Alex, on the issue of slavery, the extension of slavery then to Mexico and Thoreau's thoughts about slavery. There was a non-resistance movement related to abolitionism. Can you discuss that and Thoreau's thoughts about that in regards to the Mexican War, all that was going on in this country concerning that movement?
Sure, absolutely. So slavery had obviously been a tremendously controversial issue even since the American founding, but it was really in the 1830s that abolitionism as a movement started gaining steam. The abolitionists were people who believed not just that slavery should be phased out, but that slaves should be emancipated immediately. And this made abolitionism quite a radical view. Most of the Northerners who opposed slavery believed in its sort of gradual disappearance, believed in limiting it to the old southern states and preventing its expansion into the territories, as Russ was saying. So the abolitionists were people who demanded immediate emancipation, and Thoreau's, we know that Thoreau's family subscribed to abolitionist newspapers. We know that they were reading the leading abolitionists of the day and, in fact, bringing them in to Concord to speak. So Thoreau was sort of living and breathing the atmosphere of abolitionism and was very much influenced by it. One of the interesting movements that overlaps with abolitionism is, as you mentioned, this non-resistance movement, which is really a form of Christian pacifism, which says that not only must individuals never commit acts of violence or coercion themselves, but they must refuse to associate with any group or organization that practices violence. And so for them, the government itself, since government is ultimately premised on violence, it has an army and it has prisons and a police force, was suspect. The right thing for individuals to do was to try to dissociate themselves from government, according to the non-resistance. So this is also in the air when Thoreau's a young man. And so those two movements form part of the important context for this essay as well.
And can you explain a little bit more, Russ, what it meant to be a transcendentalist? He really wouldn't have called himself a Christian. He was a transcendentalist.
Right. And, you know, it's very much of a loose philosophy that's part moral, part ethical, part political, in the ways that you can see in Alex's response. And I think it comes in the terms for this essay. I think it's most pertinent when Thoreau says that the state is insisting on treating him like he was mere flesh and blood and bones. And I think what Thoreau is trying to say there is that his sense of morality, his sense of ethics, his sense of truth and justice and right transcends any institution such as the state that would put a hold on him. In fact, Thoreau sees himself as responding to a higher law, and that law is higher than the Constitution itself, higher than the law that says he should pay taxes, higher than the law that says that just because he's a member of the United States that he should support its wars or its institutions, from the police to education to slavery. And so it was a notion about of elevating oneself above all the sordid, compromising realities that condition us as individuals.
But you have to be selective about what you object to.
Well, yes and no. I mean, they could, you know, transcendentalists objected to all sorts of things. They objected to certain dietary restrictions. Objected to, they had many different permutations. They objected to certain gender conventions, certain racial strictures. At other times, they upheld certain conventions. So they were a contradictory, amorphous set of beliefs. In fact, the leader of transcendentalism, Ralph Waldo Emerson, you know, famously said said there is no such thing as transcendentalism. So he was even trying to transcend transcendentalism, if we can get our head around that.
I'm trying. Alex, tell me about the arrest of Henry David Thoreau. Why did it happen?
Right. So Thoreau stopped paying his Massachusetts poll tax sometime in the early 1840s, 1842 or 43.
And the poll tax was?
The poll tax was, so there weren't any income taxes at the time. The poll tax was a state tax that was levied on all adult men between the ages of 20 and 70, sort of a yearly state tax. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't very much money. I think it was about $1.50 a person at the time, which even then wasn't a great deal of money. Now, Thoreau stopped paying his tax as a matter of principle to oppose what he thought was Massachusetts collaboration in the institution of slavery. But nobody paid any attention to his refusal to pay taxes until several years later. It wasn't until the summer of 1846 that he was actually confronted by Sam Staples, who was the local constable and tax collector in Concord. Now, Thoreau had just walked into town to get a shoe fixed, and he happened to run into Staples in the street, and Staples said, "Look, Henry, you know, I'm going to have to collect that tax pretty soon." And actually, Staples then made him an offer and said, "Look, Henry, you know, if you're hard up, I can probably cover you." And Thoreau, of course, didn't want any part of that and said, "Look, you know, I'm not paying my taxes as a matter of principle. I don't intend to start now." Staples then sort of asked him, well, you know, what do you expect me to do about that? At which point Thoreau apparently said something like, "Well, look, you can resign your office if you don't like it." and Staples got a little angry at this point and said, "Look, Henry, you know, I'm going to have to take you to jail sooner or later over this." And Thoreau apparently responded, "Well, now's as good a time as any." So Staples took him off to jail, put him in there, and went home. Word spread pretty quickly that Thoreau had been arrested, and somebody, we don't know exactly who, though most people think it was Thoreau's Aunt Maria, promptly put up the money to cover Thoreau's tax. Actually went over to Staples' house to deliver the money. Staples at that point had apparently taken off his boots and wasn't going to go back out to the jail at that point, and just said, "Look, he can spend the night there." So Thoreau did famously spend that night in jail. Thoreau was then pretty peeved when he discovered the next morning that somebody had paid his tax, right? He was trying to make a grand gesture, and he didn't appreciate his aunt's interference. And so he actually, when Staples came in the morning to get him out of jail, he actually initially didn't want to leave and was sort of steamed as he was leaving that somebody had interfered. But that's sort of the story.
Hmm. And then after he gets released, Russ, he joined a Huckleberry party who were impatient to put themselves under my conduct. Can you talk about what that is? Who are the people who were impatient to be put under his conduct? What the heck is a Huckleberry party?
Yeah, I don't think we have those too much today anymore.
No.
And Alex can help me out here if I need it, which is, you know, Thoreau's an educator, a school teacher in the town, and the Huckleberry Party is, you know, a party to go collect these berries that can be made into pies and jams. But what is significant about this is the minute he gets out, he re-encounters the town. He re-encounters the town's citizens, and he says about these citizens, right, they were impatient to be put themselves under my conduct. And he talks about how the horse is tackled. And I think what he's saying is that people are so unlike him, Henry David Thoreau, that they want to be put under somebody's conduct, that they want to be like this horse. They want to be tackled. They want the state to tell them what to do. We want to be in these external prisons because it is much easier to live life in a realm or in where we don't have consciousness about our actions, where we don't reflect upon the political and ethical moral compromises that we make to live in a society. And so Thoreau here, I think, is being very deeply ironic in saying the rest of citizens are like children. They have they see the state in a paternal relation to themselves, and they understand themselves in ways that infantilize their own political role as citizens.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk more about the role of government and when the purpose of government, Alex. What does Thoreau see as the purpose of government, and can it be, and does he ever give examples of it being benevolent?
Yeah, so that's a big question. I mean, so one of the controversies about Thoreau and civil disobedience is, well, should we read this text as an outright rejection of government?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Should we read it as essentially an anarchist text? And there are some lines very early in the essay that suggest that maybe that's the way Thoreau wanted us to read it, right? He says the government which governs best is the one that governs not at all. There's reason to believe, though, I think, that he pulls back significantly from that view. He does think that government has an important role to play in guaranteeing personal liberties, among other things. I mean, one of the things he admired, though he was critical of the American Constitution in many ways, he admired the Bill of Rights and its guarantee of individual civil and political liberties. That was very important to him. And he also talks about government, you know, is useful for certain expedient purposes, right? He says he pays his highway tax because he uses the highways and they're useful enough, right? So he thought that government could be useful for accomplishing certain common purposes as well.
Do you want to add to that, Russ?
The only thing I would add, and Alex is exactly right, is when he does say that government is best which governs not at all, he follows it up by saying, when men are prepared for it.
Mm.
And I think that's the big hedge that he's making, right, is, well, are we prepared for civil disobedience? Are we prepared for a society where we need less government because we can govern ourselves? And that's the question. Or do we need to be tackled like that horse on its way to a Huckleberry party?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guests. We're talking about – it's our book club for December, and we're talking about the highly important essay by Henry David Thoreau, 1849. He wrote it, Civil Disobedience. And we have two guests with us. Russ Castronovo is professor of English and American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Alex Zakaris is professor of political philosopher and associate professor of political science at the University of Vermont. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, if you'd like to use that, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also send a tweet at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now. Let's start with Vincent in Dodgeville. Hi, Vincent.
Hello. Yeah, my question is the exact title of the essay. Was it On the Duty of Civil Disobedience? Because that's a lot stronger title than just civil disobedience. And, you know, what's the extent of the duty? I don't think he said we have a duty to try to right all wrongs in the world because we do have a right to live our lives, but is he saying that when we actively collaborate with an injustice or are part of an injustice, then we have a duty to oppose it nonviolently?
Yeah, that's a terrific question, actually. And the question, the essay's title is a really interesting one. Actually, the original title of the essay was Resistance to Civil Government. And it wasn't until the essay was republished after Thoreau's death that the title was changed to Civil Disobedience. And so far as we know, that wasn't Thoreau's change. It was probably an editor changing the title to make it a little bit less militant after the Civil War, because resistance to civil government sounded a little bit too much like the Confederate resistance to the Union. And the On the Duty of Civil Disobedience is a title that gets created by some British editors when they republished the text. So the title has gone through a bunch of different iterations, but the original title, Thoreau's title, was Resistance to Civil Government.
That's interesting. What happened with this essay? Was it widely circulated, Russ?
You know, it has a certain connection, and Alex can help me here with the United States Democratic Review, right? And whose motto is something very close to that government is best, which governs least. And it circulates and in ways that also are consistent with some of the more, let's say, militant statements that Thoreau made in supporting Captain John Brown when he invaded the South at Harper's Ferry in 1860. And it circulates, as we've already said, to people like Gandhi and King, which I really think is an important thing for us to recognize, because it suggests to us that American literature isn't only this provincial enclave, but that really has a resonance, an impact that makes itself felt in international situations. And so when I think we're talking about the circulation of civil disobedience, we want to have a long view, not just thinking about how it what circles or who read it in 1849, but how it's been read, you know, across 150 years.
Yes.
That's right. You know, let me speak to that for just a minute, too, because this is a really interesting question. This text is very much unlike the other three texts that you've discussed on the show so far, because when it's first published, it is completely ignored. It has absolutely no effect. It was published in 1849 in an obscure journal called Aesthetic Papers. Very few people even read the journal. Those people who did read it focused on a couple of contributions by two better-known authors, Emerson and Hawthorne. We only know of one reviewer of that journal who actually mentions Thoreau's essay at all. So really, for 40 years after its publication, it gets no attention at all. It's sort of dormant. And its first serious audience is actually a British audience in the late 19th century. Late 19th century British socialists start taking an interest in Thoreau, and it's through their republication of civil disobedience that Gandhi, who's working as a lawyer in South Africa at the time in the early 20th century, comes across the text. So in America, even into the 20th century, Thoreau is gradually rediscovered as an apolitical nature writer, essentially, and it really isn't until the mid-1950s and the 1960s that civil disobedience becomes widely read in America. So it's one of these texts that has a delayed effect.
Fascinating.
Unlike the other texts that you've been discussing.
And go back to Gandhi for a moment, both of you. Is it true that he carried a very well-read copy of Civil Disobedience in his pocket for the many, many years that he was leading the independence movement? And did it form a basis of his philosophy about change, political change, and how to achieve it?
You know, so far as we know, Gandhi did carry with him, I don't know how long he did, but for a time anyway, he was seen carrying around Civil Disobedience. And we know that it was quite influential for him, as it was for King. Now, this is an interesting, and this connects to your caller's question. One of the interesting questions about the essay is whether it is, in fact, about nonviolent resistance specifically. Certainly, Gandhi and King read it that way, but mm-hmm. I think that's a mistake. Actually.
Really?
Whereas Thoreau's own act, the one that put him in jail, was a nonviolent act, Thoreau was not himself committed to nonviolence. We know that because he later wrote a famous essay in defense of John Brown, who violently tried to start a slave rebellion in the South. But even in Civil Disobedience, you see some hints of that. You know, he says there's a line in which he says, in which he talks about the possibility of blood flowing, and he doesn't seem, he says, here's the line, but even suppose blood should flow, is there not a sort of blood shed when the conscience is wounded, right? So he isn't specifically defending nonviolence in this essay,
mm-hmm.
even though Martin Luther King says that his first exposure to the theory of nonviolent resistance was in Thoreau's Civil Disobedience.
Hmm.
So that's been that has been one of the essay's important legacies.
Hmm. Do you agree with that analysis, Russ?
Yeah, and I would contextualize it just a bit more or second what Alex is saying, because I think he's certainly right. And listen to what Gandhi said about the essay. He says that it's about, quote, suffering humanity. The essay has been sanctified by suffering. And I don't know that we should see Thoreau as someone who is as passive as that, who saw the essay about a certain type of resignation. Thoreau, you know, had at the core of his philosophy, this notion of a resolute, hardy, inviolate individual, and one who would not perhaps suffer all the injustices of the state. So I'm not trying to mischaracterize Gandhi here. Far be it from me to do that. But I am trying to say that Gandhi puts a particular spin on the duty of civil disobedience by aligning it with a type of suffering that I think Alex is quite right to say we need to be hesitant about attributing that and to Thoreau as well.
We welcome more phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655 for you to join our book club discussion here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Henry David Thoreau's 1849 essay, Civil Disobedience, is what we're talking about. And we have two guests with us, Russ Castronovo, who is professor of English and American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Alex Zakaris, political philosopher and associate professor of political science at the University of Vermont. Dave in Eau Claire, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. As I listen to this analysis of Thoreau's essay, it makes me think of a modern movement of individuals that's nonviolent that's going on in America and has since about 2008. And it involves re-empowering the individual and protecting it from an overexpensive and overpowerful government. And it's been peaceful. It has attempted to restore our rights as set up by our founders. And it's called the Tea Party. And I think that that is liberalism in the classical sense, just like Thoreau.
Are members of the Tea Party reading Civil Disobedience? Do you know?
By what I've heard of it thus far, it sounds like we should. It sounds like it would align very much with the modern day Tea Party if people really understood it. But unfortunately, the media totally attacked and misaligned what the Tea Party really stands for.
All right. Thanks for the call. Alex.
Yeah, so that's, a great question. There certainly is a strong libertarian streak in Thoreau. Thoreau, like Emerson and other transcendentalists, placed a great deal of value on individual freedom and was suspicious of government overreach. Thoreau himself probably would not have been a Tea Partier, however, because he was suspicious of political organizations and movements of all kinds, including abolitionism, right? He was one of those who believed that, look, social and political reform has to begin with the reform of the self, has to begin with our own efforts to simplify our lives, to live according to the dictates of our own conscience, right? So it's no accident that his own act of rebellion was an individual act. He wasn't interested in joining movements, in attending rallies, in trying to affect reform through political means. In fact, this is something we'll want to talk about in Civil Disobedience. He's pretty disdainful about political participation of all kinds. He would much rather take direct action, direct individual action. And so, of course, the form of action we're talking about here is the refusal to pay taxes. But Thoreau also, for instance, was an active participant in the Underground Railroad. So he helped escaped slaves find their way to freedom in Canada. These are the kinds of actions that Thoreau could take individually to try to separate himself from the injustice that he associated with the American government.
And did he hope for or try to persuade many, many other people to do the same so that as one analyst of Civil Disobedience has said, there may have been a hope to clog the jails and the machinery of the state and make laws unenforceable.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. So he, there are two ways of understanding the gesture that he describes in Civil Disobedience. One is simply as an act of conscientious refusal, right? And understood this way, it's essentially a private act. Thoreau wants to protect his own moral integrity, thinks that to do that he has to refuse association with an unjust state, and so tries to accomplish that moral integrity by withdrawing himself from the state. Now, another way of understanding the act is as an act of sort of civil protest, right? And it's clear in writing the essay, he's trying to hold up his actions as an example, right? He's trying to sort of invite others to follow. And in fact, he says in the text of civil disobedience, look, if only a handful of people did this, right, the state would grind to a halt. The state requires that one of the powerful thoughts in civil disobedience is, look, any state, in order to continue functioning, requires that citizens be more or less docile and compliant, obey the laws, pay their taxes, do as they're told. Once even a small handful of citizens start, prominent, respected citizens especially, start refusing to do that, the state has a real problem.
Hmm. And what did his fellow citizens think about all of this? Did they admire him, Russ, or did they think he was crazy?
Well, if we turn to the essay itself, you know, he talks about the way that he feels, you know, in jail and when he comes out of jail as being completely alien to his citizens. So it's almost being a removed from their everyday lives, and that he sees them differently. They see him in this mocking way, right? He talks about how coming out of jail, how people used to be greeted after their release in this with this mocking gesture where they would look through their fingers as though they were the bars of a jail cell and say, you know, how do you do, convict? And Thoreau, I think, is saying, you know, actually, I see you better than you see me. I see you as you are tied to those very institutions, right, that compromise you on a daily basis. I am the one who is free because I am in jail. I am inside your institutions, but I am not supporting them. And so I think that in his immediate context, Thoreau saw himself as a complete a stranger. Someone who didn't have a type of support from his fellows. And in fact, you know, if we go back to the beginning of the program, the support that he got, somebody paying his poll tax for him, likely his aunt, that was the type of support he didn't want. What
right.
he wanted
yeah.
was a type of support where he had other people who were taking this principled stand against a government mm-hmm. that supported slavery.
Let's go to Phoenix in Madison. Hi, Phoenix.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm just wondering, back in the 60s here in Madison, it seemed like civil disobedience was encouraged. There was a positive movement, and it was a hip thing to do. And now it's almost as if you're protesting authority. There's like a negative stigma attached. You're a hippie, you're a weirdo. And I'm wondering, what does Thoreau, like, how does he look into that in his essay, and how does his ideas carry over today in the whole protest movement?
That's an interesting question, Russ.
You know, I should take this question indeed because I know Phoenix. Phoenix is one of the students in my class,
oh,
and
great.
I recognize her voice.
Thanks for calling Phoenix.
So, you know, there's two ways to look at this, and Phoenix is quite right. We could see Thoreau, and many have, as the prototypical hippie of the day, the prototypical person who's going to check out and go live in the woods and not traffic with this, you know, with the state. But there's also, I think, something underlying our question that's a little bit more difficult for us to grapple with, and that's, well, how do we deal with the legacy of Thoreau's protest, especially if protest is seen as this unpopular gesture? What does Thoreau think about that, right? What does Thoreau give us any sort of counsel for thinking about what it means to take a stand and then be castigated and ridiculed for that stand? And I think that's why I think that's partly why the essay has been such a important source for protesters, because they realize, you know, I'm not alone out there. Here's this important voice whose words give me comfort. They provide an example. They show me what it means to act upon principle and insist upon one's own sense of justice. So Thoreau, I think, is one of the reasons he's been so important to us, is that he reminds us that we are not alone in taking these individual acts.
Hmm. Thank you so much, Phoenix, for the call. How important is Thoreau? Where do you place him before your students in terms of serious analysis of his work? Do you require students to read Alex, Civil Disobedience, Walden?
I do, actually. I assign Civil Disobedience in my introduction to political philosophy, and you know, it certainly is one of the most widely assigned texts now across many disciplines.
Now, that said, I don't think, I think what's powerful, just to connect what Russ was just saying, what's powerful about the text is not the coherence of its argument. This is not the most carefully argued text that will hold up to careful philosophical scrutiny. What's powerful about it is the intensity of expression, the courage of the example that he sets, and the sort of message of individual power that it conveys.
Thank you, Phoenix, so much for your call. Stephen Madison writes, well, yes, it's safe now to consider a tax protest of the 1840s. We consider these arguments only at a very safe remove from any possible application here and now. Russ?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if I agree with that. I think Thoreau is an inspiration. And this is what, you know, when Dave, I think he was calling from Fond du Lac or La Crosse, was talking about when he mentioned the Tea Party. And we also, you know, and that's something that came up when you and I were discussing Tom Paine with the people of Wisconsin, when the people also made that gesture, made that link between Tom Paine's anti-governmental stance and the Tea Party. And we can – and the thing – what makes Thoreau, like Paine, so resonant is that we can't conscript him to any single party. We can't say this is a Republican or a Libertarian or a Democratic point of view, right? So we can think in that case that his ideas have also inspired, you know, protest movements like Occupy Wall Street, right, where you have people who are objecting to government's participation in the unjust system of what they would feel of finance capitalism. So I think there is a way in which people consistently call upon civil disobedience, and even that name has stuck. And by using that phrase, civil disobedience, it links us to this august lineage of protesters who have thought earnestly and devoutly about their actions. And so I don't think that we are at that sort of remove. I think that it resonates.
Let me just ask you a question, Alex, because it's come to mind. But don't you run a risk in writing an essay that isn't very clear or very well developed if you've got the Tea Party, British socialists, Gandhi, Tolstoy? I mean, all of those people can justify whatever their political ideas are, and they're vastly different, and the ramifications of their party's ideas are vastly different. Did he fall short of the mark here and not in being interpreted to be, well, here's the guy, Thoreau wrote about this, we embrace what he had to say and we're following his thoughts. How can you have so many people of so many persuasions embrace it?
It's a really interesting question. I think it is one of the really fascinating questions about this text. How is it that people of so many different persuasions have come to idolize this text? One of the answers we might give is that, you know, Thoreau, like Emerson, could write in a fairly cryptic way and in a way that was not, I mean, he wasn't a philosopher by training, and he, you know, he was interested in opening up new lines of thought, challenging his readers and audiences to think for themselves, putting interesting and conflicting claims on the table and challenging his readers to make sense of them and do something with them themselves. So Thoreau didn't want, like Emerson, he didn't want followers, he didn't want acolytes. He wanted to sort of inspire and encourage intellectual self-reliance, like other transcendentalists. And so there's, you know, there's he takes a certain pleasure in being provocative and a little bit cryptic, and he would have thought that's just fine. Let me come back to your previous question, though, because I think that there's a really important thought in this essay which is absolutely relevant to us today, and that is the thought that that appears very early in the essay, that the laws make us agents of injustice. Mm-hmm. One of Thoreau's central claims in this essay is that we, as ordinary citizens who obey the law and who pay taxes and who receive benefits from the state, we share responsibility. We are complicit in the injustices that our government commits. Right? And this is a powerful and, I think, pretty provocative thought. That is, most of us today think that on the right or the left, right, can identify things that government is doing that we think are wrong. Well, here's Thoreau saying, look, you may think that the people responsible for those actions are simply, you know, congressmen in Washington, but actually
this is a democracy, actually. They speak in your name, and you enable them when you recognize your government's legitimacy, when you pay taxes to it, when you receive benefits from it. You enable it. You become an accomplice in its injustices. So Thoreau is looking at all of us, right, and saying, so what are you going to do about it, right? Your own moral integrity is tainted. Here's what I did about it, right? But he was looking around at his fellow New Englanders just as he would look around at most citizens today. And he was saying, look, most people grumble in private about government injustice, right? But they don't do anything about it. They don't actually stake a real claim in these fights the way he did. So there's a thought that I think is absolutely applicable to us today, and we can argue about whether Thoreau's response to that thought is the right one.
A lot of people today would say, well, you vote, but he didn't do that.
He didn't. No, that's right. I mean, and that's, you know, Thoreau's relationship to democracy and democratic politics was always ambivalent, and one of the thoughts that we see in this essay about that goes like this: look, here's democracy is in a sense offering us a bargain, right? It's telling us, look, show up and vote, express your own voice, make yourself heard, but then if it turns out that you're outvoted, right? If it turns out the other side prevails, then live with the consequences and accept them as legitimate, right? So you've had a chance to have your say. Now you play by the rules and you live with the result.
Right.
And Thoreau thought, you know, that's a really tricky and in some ways a bad bargain, because what if the majority decides, as it often does and as it had done in his own day, what if the majority decides on a course of action that's really unjust? Well, democracy is then asking us to say, okay, I recognize that as legitimate because I've had my say, right, and because this reflects the will of the people, so-called. Well, Thoreau didn't want any part of that, right? He thought, look, if I vote, if I enter this game, right, then my own moral integrity is at risk, right? If the majority then decides on the wrong thing, if they decide to perpetuate slavery, if they decide in a fit of patriotic enthusiasm to support the war against Mexico, then I myself have become an accomplice.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So he didn't want to participate in those ways.
Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. We're talking, it's our book club for December, and the selection is Henry David Thoreau's 1849 essay, Civil Disobedience. Our number is 800-486-8655, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our leaders for this book club, Civil Disobedience, Russ Castronovo, Professor of English and American Studies at UW-Madison, and Alex Akaris, who's a political philosopher and Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Vermont. 800-486-8655 is our number. Marty in Douglas County, hi.
Hi, good morning. Say, I'm wondering if either of your guests know that there's a play out there called The Night Thoreau Spent in Jail. In 1970, when I was in college, I was in it, played one of those terrible townspeople shunning Henry David. But it, for all of us young hippies in that play, the message to stand up for your beliefs really resonated with us. And I think that's why I'm an artist today, is I didn't become a teacher. I didn't become a nurse. I stuck with what I wanted to do, and I think that was a big reason why. I'm hoping I can maybe broaden this a little teeny bit, and perhaps you've already talked about transcendentalism. I'm sorry I missed the first part of the show. Can you give a brief Transcendentalism 101?
Yeah, we've already talked about that, so let's make that very brief. But I like what she said, that a lot of people embrace this as stand up for your beliefs. In a nutshell, that's what a lot of people, I think, Russ, took from Civil Disobedience.
Yes, and you know Marty's point about the play is wonderful because it shows the enduring power of Thoreau's words, right? Thoreau's action was relatively insignificant, not paying $1.50 tax, as Alex tells us. But what he wrote about it, now that's something to reckon with.
Mm-hmm.
And you can think about how, you know, Marty in her own life reckoned with that, right? How she, you know, in some ways could see herself, and I think she does, as a sort of transcendentalist, right? As someone who elevated, who rose above expectations to become a nurse or an educator, which, you know, we could think about being very gender-specific roles that women were supposed to take in the 1970s. And now she's an artist, someone who, you know, through her vision, most likely, you know, thinks outside of conventions. And so we could think about that's the fallout, the continuing fallout from this essay, that it makes transcendentalist in Wisconsin today.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Marty. Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Well, this was just so interesting. I had to call, and I did read it. And the one thing that really strikes me is that Thoreau, I think he lays down the law, that lays down the premise of you don't have to follow a law if it's unjust. And he talks about not paying taxes. And I just think it's interesting that subsequent people who were influenced by him, that wasn't their main focus. They kind of refined it and picked a specific law which was more appropriate to their situation, and they decide that law. Like Gandhi went and made salt out of the sea, which was against the law, and King sat at lunch counters, his followers sat at lunch counters to integrate them, which was against the law, and then anti-nuclear protesters went and trespassed on the nuclear test site, which was against the law, and you know, not paying taxes, that's kind of problematic because, and I think that's one reason why it hasn't been a huge movement, because there are things the government does that people support. So how can you just not pay all your taxes? But anyway, that's just what I thought was interesting.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you so much for calling in. Alex?
Yeah, I think that's really well put. I mean, as we touched on a little bit before, the central ethical premise in this text is that we ought never commit injustice, right? So, and he says, you know, I didn't come to make the world a better place. I came to live in it, but I have to make sure as I go about living my own life that I'm not standing on another man's shoulders, that I'm mm-hmm. not contributing to injustice or harming others. And that's, I think, what he would say about, you know, he too acknowledged that there was plenty of good in the American government. I mean, he says from a certain point of view, you know, the American Constitution and government are quite good. But from a higher point of view, he says, they're not at all, because they're so deeply implicated in this central moral evil that is slavery. And so even, you know, even if the American government, he would say, does some things right, the depth of this evil that was written into its very constitution, in Thoreau's view, made it impossible for virtuous men to associate with. Mm. So the emphasis on dissociating oneself from injustice would lead him, and he would want it to lead others to dissociate themselves entirely from government in cases of radical or extreme injustice.
Isn't it something how some people like Thoreau saw it as this fundamental evil, and other people at that time saw nothing at all?
Go ahead, Alex.
No, I mean, that is absolutely fascinating. And it is, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about this essay is that Thoreau doesn't spend any time arguing that slavery is wrong or that the war is wrong, right? He is addressing himself to others who he expects, by and large, will agree with him. I mean, the problem that he's addressing in the essay is a problem of moral courage, not of moral knowledge, right? The problem is that so many of his fellow New Englanders who see, like he does, that there's something wrong with slavery are unwilling to follow that thought where he thought it would naturally lead, which would be to acts of disobedience and serious resistance.
Yeah. Let's take at least one more call. Jeff in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. Three real quick points. First point, dissension is the highest form of patriotism as far as I'm concerned. There was an expression, I think from the 60s, saying that America right or wrong. And people tend not to quote the whole verse where it says America right or wrong. When it's right, keep it right. When it's wrong, make it right. That's the first point. Second point is when you compare the author who wrote The Wizard of Oz, the book, not the movie. He's going through the same thing, I think, at his time, the corruption and whatnot of his political generation. The third part is we don't question authority anymore, unfortunately, and that stems partially from our educational system. Abu Ghraib should have never happened, but the underlings didn't know to say no.
Mm.
And that's part of the problem.
Mm. A very interesting point. Almost out of time. Russ, can you comment briefly?
Yeah, very briefly. I'll take two of the points just as that your caller is exactly right. Thoreau believes that dissent is the highest form of American patriotism. And, you know, the reason why I teach essays like Civil Disobedience is because when you have young men and women who are in situations, whether it's Abu Ghraib, whether it's, you know, in some sort of banking scandal, you want them making a decision that's based on justice.
Mm-hmm.
And
Thank
I believe
you.
That this...
I'm sorry, we're out of time. No, thank you
cool
both
enough.
So much. It was really a fascinating conversation. Thanks, Alex.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Russ. Talk to you again.
Anytime, Kathleen.
Yeah, okay, you're on, sir. You got a deal. Our book club discussion, Civil Disobedience, Back to School Book Club. Our next book club selection is The Awakening by Kate Chopin. It's described as an early feminist piece, and we'll discuss it at 10 o'clock on January 30th. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. Thanks to Russ Castronovo, UW-Madison, Alex Zakaris from University of Vermont.